The Stars, Like Dust, by Isaac Asimov. Narrated by Stephen Thorne. Chapter 1. The Bedroom Murmured. The bedroom murmured to itself gently. It was almost below the limits of hearing, an irregular little sound, yet quite unmistakable, and quite deadly. But it wasn't that which awakened Byron Farrell and dragged him out of a heavy, unrefreshing slumber. He turned his head restlessly from side to side in a futile struggle against the periodic burr on the end table. He put out a clumsy hand without opening his eyes and closed contact. "Hello?" he mumbled. Sound tumbled instantly out of the receiver. It was harsh and loud, but Byron lacked the ambition to reduce the volume. It said, "May I speak to Byron Farrell?" Byron said fuzzily,
"Speaking. What do you want?"
"May I speak to Byron Farrell?" The voice was urgent. Byron's eyes opened on the thick darkness. He became conscious of the dry unpleasantness of his tongue and the faint odor that remained in the room. He said, "Speaking, who is this?" It went on, disregarding him, gathering tension, a loud voice in the night. "Is anyone there? I would like to speak with Byron Farrell." Byron raised himself on one elbow and stared at the place where the visiphone sat. He jabbed at the vision control, and the small screen was alive with light. "Here I am," he said. He recognized the smooth, slightly asymmetric features of Sander Jaunty.
"Call me in the morning, Jaunty."
He started to turn the instrument off once more when Jaunty said, "Hello. Hello, is anyone there? Is this University Hall room 526? Hello." Byron was suddenly aware that the tiny pilot light, which would have indicated a live sending circuit, was not on. He swore under his breath and pushed the switch. It stayed off. Then Jaunty gave up and the screen went blank and was merely a small square of featureless light. Byron turned it off. He hunched his shoulder and tried to burrow into the pillow again. He was annoyed. In the first place, no one had the right to yell at him in the middle of the night. He looked quickly at the gently luminous figures just above the headboard. 3:15. House lights wouldn't go on for nearly 4 hours. Besides, he didn't like having to wake in the complete darkness of his room. 4 years' custom had not hardened him to the Earthman's habit of building structures of reinforced concrete, squat, thick, and windowless. It was a thousand-year-old tradition dating from the days when the primitive nuclear bomb had not yet been countered by the force field defense. But that was past. Nuclear warfare had done its worst to Earth. Most of it was hopelessly radioactive and useless. There was nothing left to lose, and yet architecture mirrored the old fears, so that when Byron woke, it was to pure darkness. Byron rose on his elbow again. That was strange. He waited. It wasn't the fatal murmur of the bedroom he had become aware of. It was something perhaps even less noticeable and certainly infinitely less deadly. He missed the gentle movement of air that one took so for granted, that trace of continuous renewal. He tried to swallow easily and failed. The atmosphere seemed to become oppressive even as he realized the situation. The ventilating system had stopped working. And now he really had a grievance. He couldn't even use the visiphone to report the matter. He tried again to make sure. The milky square of light sprang out and threw a faint, pearly luster on the bed. It was receiving, but it wouldn't send. Well, it didn't matter. Nothing would be done about it before day anyway. He yawned and groped for his slippers, rubbing his eyes with the heels of his palms. No ventilation, huh? That would account for the queer smell. He frowned and sniffed sharply two or three times. No use. It was familiar, but he couldn't place it. He made his way to the bathroom and reached automatically for the light switch, although he didn't really need it to draw himself a glass of water. It closed, but uselessly. He tried it several times, peevishly. Wasn't anything working? He shrugged, drank in the dark, and felt better. He yawned again on his way back to the bedroom where he tried the main switch. All the lights were out. Byron sat on the bed, placed his large hands on his hard, muscled thighs, and considered. Ordinarily, a thing like this would call for a terrific discussion with the service staff. No one expected hotel service in a college dormitory, but by space there were certain minimum standards of efficiency one could demand. Not that it was of vital importance just now. Graduation was coming, and he was through. In 3 days, he'd be saying a last goodbye to the room and to the University of Earth, to Earth itself, for that matter. Still, he might report it anyway, without particular comment. He could go out and use the hall phone. They might bring in a self-powered light or even rig up a fan so he could sleep without psychosomatic choking sensations. If not, to space with them. 2 more nights. In the light of the useless visiphone, he located a pair of shorts. Over them, he slipped a one-piece jumper and decided that would be enough for the purpose. He retained his slippers. There was no danger of waking anybody, even if he clumped down the corridors in spiked shoes, considering the thick, nearly soundproof partitions of this concrete pile, but he saw no point in changing. He strode toward the door and pulled at the lever. It descended smoothly, and he heard the click that meant the door release had been activated, except that it wasn't. And although his biceps tightened into lumps, nothing was accomplished. He stepped away. This was ridiculous. Had there been a general power failure? There couldn't have been. The clock was going. The visiphone was still receiving properly. Wait. It could have been the boys, bless their erratic souls. It was done sometimes, infantile, of course, but he'd taken part in these foolish practical jokes himself. It wouldn't have been difficult, for instance, for one of his buddies to sneak in during the day and arrange matters. But no, the ventilation and lights were working when he had gone to sleep. Very well, then, during the night. The hall was an old, outmoded structure. It wouldn't have taken an engineering genius to hocus the lighting and ventilation circuits, or to jam the door, either. And now they would wait for morning and see what would happen when good old Byron found he couldn't get out. They would probably let him out toward noon and laugh very hard. Aha, said Byron grimly under his breath. All right, if that's the way it was. But he would have to do something about it, turn the tables some way. He turned away and his toe kicked something which skidded metallically across the floor. He could barely make out its shadow moving through the dim visiphone light. He reached under the bed, patting the floor in a wide arc. He brought it out and held it close to the light. They weren't so smart. They should have put the visiphone entirely out of commission instead of just yanking out the sending circuit. He found himself holding a small cylinder with a little hole in the blister on the top. He put it close to his nose and sniffed at it. That explained the smell in the room, anyway. It was hypnite. Of course, the boys would have had to use it to keep him from waking up while they were busy with the circuits. Byron could reconstruct the proceedings step by step now. The door was jimmied open, a simple thing to do, and the only dangerous part, since he might have wakened then. The door might have been prepared during the day, for that matter, so that it would seem to close and not actually do so. He hadn't tested it. Anyway, once open, a can of hypnite would be put just inside, and the door would be closed again. The anesthetic would leak out slowly, building up to the 1 in 10,000 concentration necessary to put him definitely under. Then they could enter, masked, of course. Space. A wet handkerchief would keep out the hypnite for 15 minutes, and that would be all the time needed. It explained the ventilation system situation. That had to be eliminated to keep the hypnite from dispersing too quickly. That would have gone first, in fact. The visiphone elimination kept him from getting help, the door jamming kept him from getting out, and the absence of lights induced panic. Nice, kids, Byron snorted. It was socially impossible to be thin-skinned about this. A joke was a joke and all that. Right now, he would have liked to break the door down and have done with it. The well-trained muscles of his torso tensed at the thought, but it would be useless. The door had been built with nuclear blasts in mind. Damn that tradition. But there had to be some way out. He couldn't let them get away with it. First, he would need a light. A real one, not the immovable and unsatisfactory glow of the visiphone. That was no problem. He had a self-powered flashlight in the clothes closet. For a moment, as he fingered the closet door controls, He wondered if they had jammed that too, but it moved open naturally and slid smoothly into its wall socket. Byron nodded to himself. It made sense. There was no reason, particularly, to jam the closet, and they didn't have too much time anyway. And then, with a flashlight in his hand, as he was turning away, the entire structure of his theory collapsed in a horrible instant. He stiffened, his abdomen ridging with tension, and held his breath, listening. For the first time since awakening, he heard the murmuring of the bedroom. He heard the quiet, irregular, chuckling conversation it was holding with itself, and recognized the nature of the sound at once. It was impossible not to recognize it. The sound was Earth's death rattle. It was the sound that had been invented 1,000 years before. To be exact, it was the sound of a radiation counter, ticking off the charged particles and the hard gamma waves that came its way, the soft clicking electronic surges melting into a low murmur. It was the sound of a counter, counting the only thing it could count. Death. Softly, on tiptoe, Byron backed away. From a distance of 6 feet, he threw the white beam into the recesses of the closet. The counter was there in the far corner, but seeing it told him nothing. It had been there ever since his freshman days. Most freshmen from the outer worlds bought a counter during their first week on Earth. They were very conscious of Earth's radioactivity then and felt the need of protection. Usually they were sold again to the next class, but Byron had never disposed of his. He was thankful for that now. He turned to the desk where he kept his wristwatch while sleeping. It was there. His hand was shaking a little as he held it up to the flashlight's beam. The watch strap was an interwoven flexible plastic of an almost liquidly smooth whiteness. And it was white. He held it away and tried it at different angles. It was white. That strap had been another freshman purchase. Hard radiation turned it blue, and blue on Earth was the color of death. It was easy to wander into a path of radiating soil during the day if you were lost or careless. The government fenced off as many patches as it could, and of course no one ever approached the huge areas of death that began several miles outside the city, but the strap was insurance. If it should ever turn a faint blue, you would show up at the hospital for treatment. There was no argument about it. The compound of which it was made was precisely as sensitive to radiation as you were, and appropriate photoelectric instruments could be used to measure the intensity of the blueness so that the seriousness of the case might be determined quickly. A bright royal blue was the finish. Just as the color would never change back, neither would you. There was no cure, no chance, no hope. You just waited anywhere from a day to a week, and all the hospital could do was make final arrangements for cremation. But at least it was still white, and some of the clamor in Byron's thoughts subsided. There wasn't much radioactivity then. Could it be just another angle of the joke? Byron considered and decided that it couldn't. Nobody would do that to anyone else, not on Earth anyway, where illegal handling of radioactive material was a capital offense. They took radioactivity seriously here on Earth. They had to. So nobody would do this without overpowering reason. He stated the thought to himself carefully and explicitly, facing it boldly. The overpowering reason, for instance, of a desire to murder. But why? There could be no motive. In his 23 years of life, he had never made a serious enemy. Not this serious. Not murder serious. He clutched at his clipped hair. This was a ridiculous line of thought, but there was no escaping it. He stepped cautiously back to the closet. There had to be something there that was sending out radiation, something that had not been there 4 hours earlier. He saw it almost at once. It was a little box not more than 6 inches in any direction. Byron recognized it, and his lower lip trembled slightly. He had never seen one before, but he had heard of them. He lifted the counter and took it into the bedroom. The little murmur fell off, almost ceased. It started again when the thin mica partition, through which the radiation entered, pointed toward the box. There was no question in his mind. It was a radiation bomb. The present radiations were not in themselves deadly. They were only a fuse. Somewhere inside the box, a tiny nuclear bomb was constructed. Short-lived artificial isotopes heated it slowly, permeating it with the appropriate particles. When the threshold of heat and particle density was reached, the pile reacted, not in an explosion, usually, although the heat of reaction would serve to fuse the box itself into a twist of metal, but in a tremendous burst of deadly radiation that would kill anything living within a radius of 6 feet to 6 miles, depending on the bomb's size. There was no way of telling when the threshold would be reached, perhaps not for hours, and perhaps the next moment. Byron remained standing, helplessly, flashlight held loosely in his damp hands. Half an hour before, the visiphone had awakened him, and he had been at peace then. Now he knew he was going to die. Byron didn't want to die, but he was penned in hopelessly, and there was no place to hide. He knew the geography of the room. It was at the end of a corridor, so that there was another room only on one side, and of course above and below. He could do nothing about the room above. The room on the same floor was on the bathroom side, and it adjoined via his own bathroom. He doubted that he could make himself heard. That left the room below. There were a couple of folding chairs in the room, spare seats to accommodate company. He took one. It made a flat, slapping sound when it hit the floor. He turned it edgewise, and the sound became harder and louder. Between each blow, he waited, wondering if he could rouse the sleeper below and annoy him sufficiently to have him report the disturbance. Abruptly, he caught a faint noise and paused, the splintering chair raised above his head. The noise came again like a faint shout. It was from the direction of the door. He dropped the chair and yelled in return. He crushed his ear up against the crack where door joined wall, but the fit was good and the sound even there was dim. But he could make out his own name being called. Farrell. Farrell, several times over, and something else. Maybe, are you in there, or are you all right? He roared back, get the door open. He shouted it 3 or 4 times. He was in a feverish sweat of impatience. The bomb might be on the point of letting loose even now. He thought they heard him. At least, the muffled cry came back, watch out, something blaster. He knew what they meant and backed hurriedly away from the door. There were a couple of sharp, crackling sounds, and he could actually feel the vibrations set up in the air of the room. Then there followed a splitting noise, and the door was flung inward. Light poured in from the corridor. Byron dashed out, arms flung wide. Don't come in, he yelled. For the love of Earth, don't come in. There's a radiation bomb in there. He was facing 2 men. One was Jaunty. The other was Espak, the superintendent. He was only partly dressed. A radiation bomb? He stuttered. But Jaunty said, what size? Jaunty's blaster was still in his hand, and that alone jarred with the dandyish effect of his ensemble, even at this time of night. Byron could only gesture with his hands. All right, said Jaunty. He seemed quite cool about it as he turned to the superintendent. You'd better evacuate all the rooms in this area, and if you have any lead sheets anywhere on the university grounds, have them brought out here to line the corridor. And I wouldn't let anyone in there before morning. He turned to Byron. It probably has a 12 to 18 foot radius. How did it get in there? I don't know, said Byron. He wiped his forehead with the back of his hand. If you don't mind, I've got to sit down somewhere. He threw a glance at his wrist, then realized his wristwatch was still in the room. He had a wild impulse to return after it. There was action now. Students were being hustled out of their rooms. Come with me, said Jaunty. I think you had better sit down, too. Byron said, what brought you out to my room? Not that I'm not thankful, you understand. I called you. There was no answer, and I had to see you. To see me? He spoke carefully, trying to control his irregular breathing. Why? To warn you that your life was in danger. Byron laughed raggedly. I found out. That was only the first attempt. They'll try again. Who were they? Not here, Farrell, said Jaunty. We need privacy for this. You're a marked man, and I may already have endangered myself as well.